Welcome to Frameline. I'm Barbara Gosofsky, here as usual with my favorite critic, Courtney Small.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Great, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Okay, so we've got a lot more to talk about from the Sundance 2024 Film Festival because, I don't know, it was a great year. And we were both really happy with a lot of the stuff that we watched. So, Courtney, why don't you start us off?
Well, I guess we can kick off with one of the big prize winners, and that was In the Summers. It's a film that was directed by Alessandra Lacorraza. My apologies if I mispronounced that name, but it's essentially about these two sisters as they try to navigate their relationship with their father, who they visit yearly in Mexico. And their father is rather volatile. He's, you know, tends to like alcohol a little bit too much, has very much a short temper. But at the same time, he also very much loves his daughters. And that causes a lot of conflict and drama, especially as we're observing as the daughters are coming of age over subsequent summers. And certain events occur, partly because of the father's habits, his addictions, if you will. And there are a lot of unspoken issues that result because of that, that fester over the years. And I guess that's the best way I could summarize this film. It's one that a lot of people really seem to love, and I was kind of torn on it because I think the performances are good and I found the characters interesting, but I think spreading it out over a series of summers left a lot unsaid, and I was hoping for a little bit more in between. There's a lot that the audience has to fill in, and which I usually perfectly fine with, but there was just something about this particular tale that it didn't enamor me the way I was hoping to. I found the relationships fascinating, but I wasn't in love with them the way I thought I would be.
That is so interesting, considering that there's a similar topic, not similar film, and it's called Rain Us. So I'm going to first speak to In the Summers and then talk about Rain.
Yeah, we can pivot to that.
I'm wondering if you would have preferred the way the relationship between father and daughters developed in Rain Us. But they are very, very different films. And I appreciated In the Summers for the episodic structure of it, because having it happen over the years like that, it does give you a different insight as everyone's growing and developing. The girls are growing, the girls are developing. There's sort of a forward motion in them, and in a greater understanding of life, of their father, of their relationship with their father, of everything. And yet this man seems to be standing still. And that's that tension there is what really fascinated me in the film, and how it doesn't make the film stagnate. His, you know, the way he is, it doesn't stagnate because it's their reaction and their interaction with him and the other characters, some of the other characters, that keeps things really interesting. And then that keeps sort of the commentary and the insights into this relationship fresh, and it keeps it going in the film. So I really liked In the Summers, but I also really liked Rain Us. And the only thing that I'm sad about is that they're both in the same film festival at the same time, at the start of the same year. So, you know, it might be difficult, like in terms of distribution, I hope people are careful. Whoever is going to take charge of distributing these films, be very careful to differentiate them. So let me go into Rain Us, and I just hope the audience embraces them in completely different ways, because yes, in Rain Us, it's a father. In this case, a father has been an outsider, and he's he's just in a situation where he's getting to know his daughters again better. Their mother wants to take them to the States for a better life because this is the summer of 1992 in Peru, in Lima specifically, and things are very volatile socially and politically. So she wants a better life and she wants to take them with him, but she needs the dad's permission. So she reluctantly has to get him back into her life, into their lives. And she decides, well, while I'm trying to convince him to sign these papers, it'd be good for the girls if they got to know him again. And he's a complete stranger, but he's also an outsider to the family unit. So the film is very careful. This film is much more about mood and atmosphere. And it builds up this family unit and this family atmosphere, this like the place of safety inside this bubble, right? Inside Lima, where outside is all the volatility and confusion and upset. And in fact, he's coming in as part of that, right? Because these girls are like, who is this guy? And why do we have to talk to him? Why do we have to go, you know? And so it's his efforts that's also part of the film, is his efforts to try and get on their good side. And you start to see that the safety and security of the family home that the mother has so carefully nurtured and cultivated at the whole family, even the maternal grandmother, he has a different view of life. And that starts to come in and upset, not in a bad way, like the political turmoil, but it starts to just unbalance the balance that they have so carefully cultivated. So these two films are both fascinating films. You know, last week we talked about the film Daughters, and here we are again, father and two films, In the Summers and Reinas, father and daughter, and completely different insights. Except these are two fiction films that, like I said, seem to be kind of similar on the outside, but I hope that people, when these two films come out, embrace them and look at them as two separate kinds of views on the issue of father and daughters.
Mm-hmm. And as we said last week, there was a lot of films this year about fathers and children. Filmmakers are clearly going through something where they're reflecting a lot on the male role models in their lives. And this one was different because in some ways I had a similar reaction to this to how I did In the Summers, where I found the political stuff about the world that they are trying to exist in really fascinating. And I think in this and In the Summers, you have films where regardless of external forces or things that are going on, you still have family trying to remain family. Even if the bonds are strained, you can never equate ties to the familial bonds, no matter how much you may want to. But there was just something about this film, and I don't know. I guess about it was more
In
towards,
the Summers.
To Reynas, that again didn't quite connect with me. And I think as the daughters start to make certain decisions, especially towards the latter half of the film, I just didn't believe some of the choices that were being made. It felt more so in this one that the choices were being made to just kind of advance the plot. And that's where I kind of struggled with it, because there's a lot that I found really interesting. And there was a lot about this world and this family that I was happy to kind of go along with the exploration. But then characters would make choices, make certain statements, or just do certain things that would put themselves or the entire family unit in jeopardy over the silliest of things. And I just didn't quite get that. And I'd understand that maybe it's because of the detachment with the father and him trying to come into this preconceived world that they've already built, but there was just something quite missing. So when we talk about the relationship between father and children, I think some of the films that we discussed last week were, for me, a little more impactful than this one.
Well, in terms of Reynas, just to answer that and maybe give you something to think about and others to think about if they have that sort of same sense when they watch it. I felt like the father, you know, the mother's world represented safety and logic, and the father's world was a world where imagination reigned. And these are children. They're children of a certain age. And so they get drawn out eventually into this world of imagination because they've never been able to indulge it. And so believing things and making potentially what we would consider dumb decisions based on that, I thought was perfectly in keeping with their worldview, especially the worldview that he has now not imposed, but that he has sort of, his influence has sort of come in and sort of shifted their view of the world, right? So I saw it that way as a more of a character driven kind of thing and more of his influence sort of taking over. And that's why things go the way they go, and they sort of go, they blow apart like they do in terms of logic that way.
Yeah, I definitely think that both Reines and In the Summers will give a lot for people to think about and discuss. And I can't see why they connected with a lot of the audience at Sundance this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I will pivot to, since we're talking about familiar relationships, is a film that ended up, I guess, winning the screenwriting award. And it was a film titled A Real Pain. And it's the latest directorial effort from Jesse Eisenberg. And he was at Sundance last year with his feature debut. But I think this film is actually leaps and bounds better. Like, it shows his growth as a director. And he's a writer. I know he's written on several scripts. But this one I found quite captivating. And it basically involves two cousins, one played by Eisenberg and the other one played by Rory Culkin from Succession fame, as they reunite to go on this trip where they travel to Poland because their grandmother has passed away, and they want to go on this journey to kind of reconnect with her roots and where she's from. But also, these two cousins are a bit estranged. Eisenberg's character is very much he's got the stable job and family, whereas Culkin's character is more of the troubled individual, you know, was not as successful, views life completely differently, but also he's very much a people person. He's very much someone that can go and charm those around him. So these two persons essentially go to Poland, and they go on this Jewish travel tour that takes them around Poland, but also takes them to Auschwitz and surrounding areas. And over the course of this journey, you see the cousins trying to reconnect, but also kind of dealing with a lot of the unspoken tension from the past. There's a lot that's been left unsaid that kind of comes out over the course of this trip. And similar to the two previous films we've talked about, this is very much a film about families trying to bridge certain divides and realizing that at the end of the day, you're still family, for good or better or worse. And how do you evolve and grow and kind of acknowledge the unspoken thing. So I thought it was a really, really great film in terms of like just the way how the characters unfold, the drama unfolds, but also there's a lot of genuine humor in it, which makes these characters relatable even in times where you might be annoyed or frustrated. Like, you really feel Eisenberg's character's frustration at some of the things that Culkin does, and any one of us in that situation would be equally as frustrated, but then at the same time, we still understand the motivations of Culkin's character. So it's a very rewarding film in terms of like just the layers that it has. And as I said, it won the screenwriting award, but I think also it was just very popular amongst people. I mean, Eisenberg at Sundance is kind of a given now, but I think this one is definitely earned. And one other film I will give it to, since we're talking about connections, there was a film that I saw because it's both a dramedy at times, sometimes it's just a flat out comedy, but it's a film called Between the Temples, and it stars Jason Schwartzman, and he plays a cantor at a Jewish temple, and he also runs like the bar mitzvah classes, and he, through a series of events, encounters his old high school music teacher, who's played by Carol Kane. And she's going through some things in life, and she decides that she wants to have a bar mitzvah. And she's obviously much older in life. So in the process of him preparing her for her bar mitzvah, they are both kind of dealing with issues from their respective pasts. For Schwartzman's character, it's his wife had died a year ago. For Carol Kane, her husband has also passed away fairly recently, but she's also dealing with her grown son who doesn't necessarily believe in her Jewish religious roots and her wanting to reclaim that. And as the two are kind of coming together and a friendship is forming, you've also got Schwartzman's essentially two moms continually trying to set him up with nice Jewish girls from around the way. So you've got all of these balls being juggled in the air as this tale of an unconventional friendship is evolving. And it's a really difficult film to kind of put in a box, but I found it quite interesting, and especially the way how it looks at how we deal with grief, how the ways that those around us may want us to have like a certain type of life or happiness that isn't necessarily meant for us. I think often when we encounter people who are dealing with stuff, the goal for us is always to give them a quick fix. And the quick fix is usually what we think would work because it works for us, but it doesn't quite work for everyone else. So as these two vastly different individuals are bonding and forming a friendship, you've got the world around them not quite understanding how they could find joy or any resolve in this particular friendship because it doesn't fit with the structures that everyone else anticipate. So it's quite an interesting film. I don't think it completely works, but I think director Nathan Silver takes some big swings, and I appreciated that from this film.
Sounds great. Can't wait to see it.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about In the Land of Brothers? I know that's one that we both saw at the festival.
Yes. In the Land of Brothers. I was really impressed with this film. The directors won an award for directing. And it's about three members of an extended Afghan family. They arrive in Iran as refugees, and they're living on the margins of society as refugees. They're just not accepted into society. The film takes place over years, 20 years, I believe. And so it's a triptych. In each one, it sort of features everybody in its own way, but at least two parts do, but it all sort of comes back and comments on the whole family at the end anyway. So the first two parts focus on a particular family member and what they have to go through, certain things that happens, where we learn a lot about how difficult it is to live as a refugee. And I never thought for a second that this was specific to Iran. The way the filmmakers put it together, it takes on this very universal approach, like right away, this universal feel right away, because the issues of safety and housing and like having a home, having stability, you know, talk about family, like a family and safety. And I was talking about that in a previous film. And there's always the sense that your personal safety, your family safety, everything can just be wiped away in a second, even randomly. And so these things happen, life events happen, right? In the second part, especially, like something happens and there's just nothing the person can do. They're stuck. And it really brings home, sorry to use that expression, helps to give us the comprehension, the understanding, the insight, the empathy of the situation that is one that you have to watch. I think that it's really hard to discuss, but I think it's very effective, and especially the way that these filmmakers, the reason I'm glad that they got a directing award was because they take so many things and they juggle them so well with this dexterity. There's this, you know, like in terms of intimate moments versus more moments where they're taking in a situation. They frame things in a certain way when it's necessary. Like they have these like extended long shots, or they have overhead shots. They frame characters in doorways, windows. They do things like that. And then eventually you start to see that there's this pattern of looking and being watched. And so there's this constant discomfort that is happening. And then the way the filmmakers just create this and sustain it through the end. And the end is like, it's a commentary on the whole thing. It just in a different, it takes you to a different realm and gives you, it takes you on a higher plane to give you a commentary of just how impossible this situation is.
Yeah, I found, I wasn't a big fan of the ending in terms of like the latter story, because it's essentially like three key stories that are being told in this film. But I thought the first two stories were really well done. And they really kind of hit home the, not only just the difficulty of the situation that the characters find themselves in, but the emotional toll that comes with the levels of abuse that they're enduring in different ways. And you talked about characters constantly being watched and looked at. And that is something that is felt a lot, especially in the first two films and, or sorry, the first two stories. And the first one in particular, where you have the police, the local police are essentially using refugees as cheap labor, because the threat of being arrested and other things are too great. So you can get them to do, you know, fix up storage rooms, paint all of this stuff. And then there's also a case where one officer in particular, just the way how he observes one of the central characters in that first story, almost in a lustful way, you know, there's a lot of uneasiness, and that kind of view of being looked at and what happens if you try to avert the gaze also is felt in the second story as well, where something happens and person's trying to, you know, I guess give the appearance of a normal day-to-day life, but knowing full well that the employers are constantly observing their movements and asking subtle questions that could expose a lot. So I thought this was really well done. I it felt very ambitious, but also intimate as well. And I, as I said, I think the first two stories are fantastic. The third one I wasn't a fan of, but it wasn't enough for me not to recommend this film.
Yeah, what I saw happening through the first and second and into the third was sort of a progression, and that act of looking was underscoring more and more and more until the last one really underscores it, this sense of powerlessness that, you know, maybe the act of looking wasn't in the last one, but by that point the sense of powerlessness is there. And also what I felt was happening through the film, which was incredibly effective, was that each, as you got to the next part, it commented back on the previous one. And as you got to the final part, it was commenting back on the previous two, so that you can't look at any one part of the film without, except for the first one, without looking at the interrelationship of everything. And that the filmmakers in their strategies were, in the act of looking, they were also using that to get us into the act of looking, so that by the end of the film, we're implicated. Right. And it's like, it's not a cry for empathy. It's like you're drawn in. Yeah. Unless there's something emotionally wrong with you, you are empathetic. Right. By the end of the film, they just like ease you into that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was incredible.
I'm going to talk about a film that I think is going to be very divisive for audiences. And it's a film called Little Death. And it is a film directed by, I believe it's Jack Beggart, who is probably most well known for making his music videos for like Kendrick Lamar or SZA, what have you. But I believe this is his directorial debut. And it's essentially a film that is broken into two different stories that kind of intersect. And the first one involves a screenwriter who's played by David Schwimmer, a friend's fame, who is very much kind of going through it. He's depressed. He's with his girlfriend, who he is kind of getting fed up with, but doesn't quite want to break up with. And instead of kind of dealing with his depression, as much as he's going to a therapist and what have you, they keep recommending pills and medication. And part of the film is about essentially the opioid crisis and how individuals like Schwimmer's character are being fed all these pills instead of properly dealing with the issues at hand. But also, the film also has a very pointed commentary at faux white male grievance that is occurring in America. So as Schwimmer is a screenwriter and he's trying to pitch this film that he thinks is gonna, you know, be his directorial breakthrough, his girlfriend is telling him, well, you know, don't ignore these other job opportunities that are kind of sure things. But he takes an affront to that. But then anytime anyone questions his authority, questions his views on anything, he gets his back up and, you know, it's kind of like the world is against me. So he finally gets a shot to direct the film that he wants to direct from his script. He's also a screenwriter on a popular sitcom, which he doesn't even think is funny. But the funders ask him to change the gender of the character because right now, people are tired of seeing male leads. They want to see women in the forefront. And he has a bit of a midlife crisis around that. And what the film does is as he's wrestling with how to change the character of his film, which is supposed to be based on his life, as into a female, Schwimmer himself gets taken out of the role. And Gabby Hoffman becomes that character. So everyone is still referring to him, to the character as a he, but you're seeing Gabby Hoffman go through the motions of how, you know, how is he gonna take this male character and become female? So you've got that whole kind of subversive meta aspect happening. And then the second half of the story involves two young people that are tangentially involved in a crime that occurs at David Schwimmer's house, and how they are dealing with the fallout of that crime. Also, there's the whole tie into drugs, mental health, what have you. So there's a lot going on in this film. And even in those sections, there is still a lot of commentary on white male grievance. Like they go to a party at one point and two people are having a conversation where one man is telling a woman that nowadays you can't say anything anymore. They're always policing you. And she says, well, what word do you want to say that you can't? And he kind of stumbles because he doesn't really have it. Like, he's just the idea that he's being aggrieved is what is the big thing. So there's a lot going on in this film. I don't know if it always works, but I was kind of fascinated with the big swings that the director takes, because the first half of this film, to emphasize the opioid kind of drug haze that Schwimmer's character is dealing with, it uses a lot of AI images. And so you're seeing a lot of AI-based montages, which I think are a little overdone, but it also kind of sends an indication of where this industry, the film industry, is going to be going with AI technology. So you have all of that happening, the commentary about the opioid epidemic, the commentary about white male grievance, wrapped into this tale that almost kind of plays like an Altman film, in the sense that how the characters interact or make reference to other things that happened previously. Again, I don't think it always works, but I was intrigued enough that I was never bored by it. And I feel, though, that just how this film unfolds, it's going to turn a lot of people off. But I was willing to stick with it. And I do think that this director has a really promising future. I just think the script needs to be a little tighter. And also, I wish the AI stuff wasn't so prevalent in the film.
That sounds amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
But it sounds amazing in terms of, like, we got to check out this experience.
Yeah, I would still recommend.
Nuts, but
yeah, I would recommend people see, like, it was, it as I said, it kept me engaged throughout, even when I don't think it necessarily succeeded where it should. Do you want to talk about, we've been talking a lot about features, but how about we jump to a few documentaries and we can always come back to features. Do you want to talk about As We Speak?
The filmmaker J.M. Harper follows a Bronx rap artist named Kemba, who a lot of you probably know. And Kemba, we follow Kemba as he investigates this situation that's been developing in the States and abroad, but mostly the two are going through this process of investigating what's happening in the United States, where the criminal justice system, the law enforcement, they're going after rap artists for rapping about violence. And basically, it's an attack on artistic expression. That's what they're both arguing. And those are the facts that they're presenting here. And Harper, I love the way that Harper puts this film together, because it's like we're following this individual. So there's this like personal element to it, who goes around and talks to other artists. But we get Kemba's reflections as well. And we get the facts thrown in. And then we get some musical history thrown in. And every once in a while, the documentary just stops. And it has this sort of, it's self-conscious in a way, because it just stops and comments on itself and comments on what it's doing. And even though it's a very serious subject, I'm going to use the word playful, because it just stops. And it just goes, what am I doing? Like, what are we doing here? What are we doing with this documentary? And then it goes into, well, what is this? What is happening in the process of these trials? And as it explores all the different facts, and that's the thing, it's so comprehensive. I really appreciated that. It even goes into music history, which includes white artists. And as it was reciting what some of the rap lyrics are saying and how they're being used against people, and how it does really set it, we don't need to be reminded that music is art, that these are artists and this is their artistic expression that is coming under fire. But it's still, the film still sets that up in a really excellent way. But then it puts rap music in terms of the history, and Black artists in terms of the history of music, and goes all the way back to the beginning of rock, pop, you know, and all these white artists. And so as we're watching the rap artists being attacked for saying things like, I'm carrying a gun and I'm going to use it, I actually, in my head, I went, what about Johnny Cash, Mr. White Guy, country music star, going, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die, one of the most famous lines in music history. And sure enough, the film goes there. It goes, it shows you Johnny Cash to say, hey, remember when the white guy did it? And it's like, yes. So I really appreciate the comprehensiveness of it. And I think it does it in such a way that it's going to be very approachable to people. Like, people are going to be able to get into this film and really, because sometimes when you go, oh, musical history and go back to the past of like white people, like that could bore a lot of people. And, you know, they know that. But because of the playfulness, and I keep using that word, the playfulness of the structure of it, it even goes into reenactments, like fictional reenactments, to bring it all home. And so the film is operating on different levels, and it hits you on different levels. And I was really impressed with As We Speak.
Yeah, I love this film as well. And to your point about it incorporating the history, this film does it in such a fascinating way, because just structurally, we have moments of animation, as you said, reenactments, but it uses history to show that every time Black people are at the forefront of anything in music, jazz, rock and roll, what have you, there is always white pushback, and pushback that this is not appropriate for our children. This will be X, Y, and Z. We'll send them down the right path. And they show how it happens with rhythm blues, jazz, when you hit rock and roll, what have you. And the Johnny Cash example is great. And one of the things that struck me, and the line that I will always take away from this film, is they take a moment to talk about William Shakespeare, and they use Romeo and Juliet as kind of the focal point. But they point out that William Shakespeare was not, quote unquote, officially educated. There was talks of him being using plagiarism, what have you. But when he was rising up, he was essentially a young rebel of a writer. And if you look at a lot of his works have to deal with death. There's a lot of murder, crime, sex, if you will, in his works. And he is revered to this day. He is taught in schools. No one even thinks twice about that because it's considered great literature. And they basically equate William Shakespeare to being the rapper of his time, right? And essentially modern rappers are just essentially poets, right? And the way that this film unpacks the court system and how throughout history there's been a criminalization of the Black imagination and just the levels of anti-Blackness that have kind of throughout history, but also flowed into the legal systems, and why you have artists who may have been involved in Sondheim or associated with somebody, and then all of a sudden their lyrics come back and go, well, see, you said this and this in this song, and that's why you are inherently evil, guilty, what have you, and deserve punishment. It's quite fascinating when you put it in the context of history and think about people like Johnny Cash and William Shakespeare. And I think that this film is really effective in bringing all of these things to the audience in a really digestible and easy to understand manner. You don't need to even listen to rap music. You don't need to be a fan of rap music to understand why what is going on in the courts and in the legal system is really problematic to basic human rights and freedoms and artistic interpretation. So yeah, I was really taken with this film. How about we keep with the musical theme? Do you want to talk about soundtrack? I know that was a film that I didn't see.
Soundtrack to a coup d'etat. Completely different documentary. This one is so carefully put together. It's got a completely different pace. It takes on politics and history and art. And this film just it won a special award, and it was for the creative way that it put all of these elements together, and it should have, because this is a very comprehensive look. It makes some incredible points along its journey and brings up so many different historical moments and so many historical truths, and through the editing has them sort of speak to each other and bounce off each other in ways that sort of provide an insight that we wouldn't have otherwise had. And so it's magical that way. I think this is a very magical film. And it's the history of the Congo, and it's the history of the UN Security Council. It's the history of jazz music and how the US was trying to get into African politics and trying to, you know, send ambassadors, like their musicians, they sent Louis Armstrong as an ambassador to act like an ambassador, to sort of bring back insight and get people together, because everyone in the world was getting involved in the history of the Congo. And meanwhile, the Congo was just trying to get liberate, you know, aiming for liberation. But instead, all the white countries were just interfering. And it seems like, why would they send these jazz musicians? Which ironically is what Khrushchev, the Russian leader at the time, was commenting on. He was like, you can't even solve your own problems, and you're trying to get involved in another country's problems. this sort of interaction and the changing nature of relationships and our changing views of what happened at that time and what happened in that history. And the insights are incredible. I don't want to get too far into it to ruining it, but it says a lot about American and North American politics at the time, as well as bringing to light the history of colonization, you know, and the damage done and the damage like of the UN Security Council.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. How about while we have you on the musical trail, do you want to talk about Luther, Never Too Much?
Okay, so now we're
quick words with that. We're all talking about musical docs, so I figured might as well bring that in because I know you saw that one as well.
It's great because you know, it's always great when someone can work in jazz musicians, you know, like we're saying with As We Speak. You know, it seems like as soon as Black musicians get to the forefront, something happens, like the white people push back, right? So that was, you know, evident in As We Speak. It just reinforced that was something. And then meanwhile, the government was, and it seemed more and more nefarious as soundtrack to a coup d'etat. It seemed more and more nefarious, their use of these jazz musicians in world politics while they were ignoring what those jazz musicians were dealing with in their own country, right? So the reason I laugh is because that this is another film where, another documentary where we're going to get insight into a Black artist who's getting his due finally. Like this, a documentary about Luther Vandross and his influence and his cultural significance in music and in all, you know, in all ways, American and North American especially. This should have been done already, you know, and I thought the same thing about the Little Richard documentary when it was at Sundance. And so now that we have a Luther Vandross documentary, it feels like the same thing. It feels like we're finally getting a celebration of his importance in music history, and he's getting his due. And although the film is trying to, the film does a really good job of reinforcing all the great that he did, of his absolute musical genius, of his influence on so many musicians and artists at the time, that he worked with Bowie, he worked with Ben Miller, but you know, he also worked with Roberta Flack, he worked with like so many artists at the time. And he went from being like a backup singer, but he still worked as a backup singer, but it's just that he started working as his own artist with his own material, and then he became a producer, and then he got more and more influence, and he became a star. And so we get to see that history. Like it's very good at giving us that, even though it does it at a really, really fast clip, right? And then it stops to pause on celebrity and what celebrity did to Luther Vandross. And it's a universal kind of story of celebrity. People have a hard time when they're famous. Any of their sort of flaws or any of their problems that they have get magnified. And so it's difficult for them to function as individuals, or it's difficult for them to sort of not hide, but just have privacy, right? Everything is blown up in the public eye. I wish the documentary, you know, like Little Richard, like these documentaries that are made probably for television, these documentaries don't go deep enough. They're more of a, we call it hagiography. Like not a lot of, they lift the person up, which I completely agree with, but they don't, not that I want to see anything ugly about Luther Vandross, but I just would like some deeper insight.
Yeah.
You know, when you're going to make a documentary about someone, and right now we're getting too many documentaries about celebrities in general. I'm not talking about music docs, just in general. Like I'm thinking of that Sly documentary that was on Netflix, and it's like Well, that was just, you know, something like an autobiography. This is not an autobiography. Luther Vandross is not around, but you can tell there's a sort of protective core around him.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I still say, you know, this is an important watch because you'll be surprised how much influence, if you don't know already, Luther Vandross. And if you are, if you do know him, then you'll be enjoying the fact that his accomplishments are finally being celebrated.
Yeah, that sounds very good. I'm going to talk about a film that I would also put in the category of important watches, really because I think it really leaves a lot for you to think about. And that is a documentary called Desire Lines. And I use the term documentary because it is a doc, but also it plays with form in such interesting ways. It's very experimental.
It's a hybrid.
Yeah, it's definitely a hybrid because there's some dramatization incorporated into it. You've got archival footage. You've got interviews. It's really interesting and unique take on a, I would say, very interesting and unique subject, because the film by director Jules Roskam is about trans masculinity and really focusing in on trans males who are attracted to other males. And how does that get perceived within not just the global sphere, but also just within the LGBTQ plus community? And you get a lot of discussion on everything from how their sexual interactions occur, but also just in terms of if you are a trans male and have female genitalia, how is that perceived in certain fields? You know, if you are masculine presenting but have certain female features, or female presenting but, you know, are considered trans masculine, it kind of covers the spectrum of all issues related to identity, community, gender, racism. Like, there's so much that is occurring in this film, and yet it is all fascinating. It is all told in a really well-structured way where the dramatic moments fit with a lot of the interviews that it reminded me of the works of Chase Joint in terms of how you're taking figures that people may not be aware of that were very instrumental in the gay community, the LGBTQ plus IA community. And in this one, they pull up archives of, like, you know, some of the first trans males to appear on television, people that were fighting for the cause before people even knew what being a trans male was. And it's just a really fascinating and well-shot film. And even like the dramatizations and the dramatic moments, just the way how it uses the lighting, like there's a lot of the story focuses around a particular iconic bathhouse and talking about the history of that. And you're seeing the character who's essentially doing the researching also kind of coming to terms with his own sexuality. There's a lot going on, but again, it all works. And I know my critique is not doing it justice, because I think it's one that you really need to experience and just kind of let it consume you. And I think it's a wonderful film.
Yeah, it's definitely an experience. And yeah, it's definitely something that reminds me of Chase Joint as well. And I even think of, like, going back to John Grayson, although John Grayson didn't tackle trans issues. But in terms of the playfulness of the form, I really appreciated that. I mean, there's probably tons of filmmakers that we're not even talking about that. And let's not talk about this filmmaker in the context of, you know, who they remind us of, because this is a very unique and original film. The way that the film is able to take all of these, their different aspects, they're different types of film, experience, like you said, like interviews, the bathhouse scenes. The bathhouse scenes are like very erotically charged, but also very impressionistic, poetic kind of footage that sort of like acts as a through line, bringing all the different elements of the film together. I love the way that works to make everything interact. So you've got this highly intellectual experience with this erotically charged experience with this experience of people talking about their identities and coming to realize that they have not necessarily always been accepted for the way they feel, the way that they know that they are in terms of gender and in terms of sexuality. And the filmmaker brings up this issue of gender and sexuality, and why do we always have to look at one in relation to the other in a certain way? Why can't, with all the boundaries being blown open, why can't we blow those boundaries apart too? And so in creating this film that blows boundaries apart as well, you know, in this fluid cinematic form, yeah, I just found the whole thing like just very fascinating and exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely one that I highly recommend. How about we pivot slightly and maybe talk a bit about the darker side of sexuality? So I know you saw Black's Box Diaries, and I remember hearing good things about that. So do you want to give the listeners a little insight into that film?
Yeah, Black Box Diaries is, like anything that deals with sexuality gets into difficult territory, right? Because, I mean, even in Desire Lines, there were stories that people were telling that were not easy. And, you know, having your identity denied and having certain experiences and having this sort of bigotry against you, that's difficult. But in the case of Black Box Diaries, it's a difficult film because it's a story. It's not a story. It's a documentary where a journalist in Japan, this is her first film. And so she's a journalist and she decides to make a film where she's investigating her own sexual assault. And it was a high powered official in Japan who had ties to a lot of powerful people, including at the time, the president, Shinzo Abe. And so it goes through in great detail. So you know, I have to give everybody a trigger warning. It goes through in great detail the difficulty she's had, but at some point you're going to hear about what happened. But the difficulties are going to sound familiar to anyone who's like paying any attention to any films, any accounts of sexual assault where just getting heard is a big hurdle. Getting someone to believe you, and in this case, she can't get the police to believe her. They come back at her with the old, oh, it's he said versus she said, right? She can't get them to open an investigation. And that's why she has to open her own. And what's so great about this film is she's not a filmmaker. Well, she is now, but previous to this, she was not a filmmaker. So she has this dexterity with the form, just like in Desire Lines. There's this like this dexterity where she is able to fold in and play around and just create this multi-dimensional, multi-level experience of the whole thing. It's the whole thing plays out like a mystery at first, right? But she uses direct address. She first speaks into her phone, then she starts the process of speaking into the camera, then more people join her legal team, and slowly details start to emerge. Okay, so there's surveillance footage. There's footage from the news. There's her own personal footage. There's footage of her, not just speaking into the camera, but of her going to court, of her trying to get people to listen to her. There's a societal stress that she's facing, not just her own fear of being put out in public with the whole shame thing, but even her family starts to come in and go, well, we don't want to be wrapped up in your shame. We don't want to be wrapped up in your, like, we don't want to be shamed by implication. That kind of thing. And it the mystery part of it, it comes and it goes, but she can still maintain this sort of tension. And she still maintains this sort of, like, she's building something definitely that keeps you riveted until things start to happen in the case, her case, and like she starts to get somewhere, and she starts to reveal secret recordings, and then next thing you know, surprising things happen, just like in any great mystery.
Oh, that sounds really, really fascinating. I mean, a very tough subject, but definitely one that
it's worth a look. It's definitely a rewarding experience, and just grateful that she made it.
Mm-hmm. How about we, before we wrap things off, let's tie off the documentaries, because I know you saw Nocturnes, and then I'll close things off with a fiction work that I saw.
Okay.
So do you have a few quick things to say about Nocturnes?
Yes, Nocturnes. Nocturnes is one of those verite type gems that I always love seeing at film festivals, and I worry about their distribution because, you know, they're just, but this one has the climate warning to it, so maybe it will, but it's one of those, it would be beautiful to see on the big screen and just experience it with people. The pacing of it, I should tell you about it. It takes place in the Himalayas, and there are there's a scientist and her team. Her team is made up of indigenous folk who know the landscape and the area, so they're helping her to measure the moth population. She can't measure the entire moth population, so she's decided to focus on the hawk moth. And they set up these screens. It's like something out of an art movie or a space age movie. You've got this like amazing landscape, and then you've got these brightly lit white screens that the moths are drawn to at night. And so this is the scene that we keep seeing, right? And then they go, and her helpers photograph. The screen has been divided up into squares so that wherever a moth lands, they can figure out a measurement, right? Depending on how the moth lands where. But and so you see the assistants taking photographs so that she can take them back then and then do all the like boring scientific measurement stuff. But what we get is this contemplative, amazing, like we're just thrown into this beautiful, incredible natural surrounding with just the sound of these moths, really, and the other sounds of the Himalayas, the natural world in the Himalayas, and just their quiet whispers every once in a while as they're talking about, look at that one, and look at that one, and look at that one. And the climate message here is that the moths are not showing up like they used to. And so there are implications from that. And like any great verite, there's a lot that we pick up and we infer. But mostly it's being in that setting. And that's the great thing, is like it envelops us in this process, in this setting, in their atmosphere, and gets us to focus on this incredible sight. It's like the sight of this screen full of moths is like, it's kind of surreal in a way, and it's kind of incredible. And if you love nature, And if you're interested in the environment at all, but it's a beautiful landscape. It's the Himalayan mountains, so it's incredible.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. I'm going to end off on a film that is a completely different tone than the one that you were just speaking about. I'm going to talk about Kidnapping Inc. And if the title does not give it away, there's a kidnapping that occurs, and this is a action comedy, dark comedy, that essentially takes place in Port-au-Prince, which is apparently one of the world's most notorious places for kidnapping. So the film follows two, I guess you could say, bumbling criminals, Doc and Zoe, as they are hired to kidnap the son of a prominent politician. And there are a series of events partly related to Zoe's lack of self-control. He's very quick-tempered and obviously doesn't think things through. But through a series of events, the hostage ends up being killed. And they have to figure out how to get the hostage back to their boss and also explain the fact that the hostage is no longer alive. And that kind of sets off a series of kind of comedic events where they're dealing with just the main streets of Port-au-Prince, trying to acquire vehicles after something happens to their vehicle. Then there's this masked person on a motorcycle who also seems to be hunting them. And you've got all this kind of swirling. And then there's the whole stuff with the politician and the ransom that is being requested from the politician and how he's trying to deal, you know, with a firm hand with these people who have taken his power while also running for office. So there's a underlying political commentary that is going on in this film. And I don't know if the political commentary and some of the emotional beats related to the political climate of the area work as well. I think this film is far more entertaining when you just look at it as a straight, you know, goofy action comedy. I don't think it earns the emotional beats that it strives for. But I mean, I did laugh a lot. It is quite funny. And I mean, you have the two central characters are, you've got like the loose cannon, then you also have Doc, who's a little more even keel. He's trying to get the job done, but he's working with the guy that's not necessarily the sharpest tool when it comes to like decorum and whatnot. So a lot of zaniness incurs. And as I said, it's an action comedy. It's quite violent. A lot of the violence is played for laughs, but just you know, there it is a violent film. And it was playing in the midnight section. So, not, you know, up here we would be the equivalent of like our Midnight Madness, but it's not quite gory enough for necessarily that type of labeling that we tend to associate with Midnight Madness. But if you're looking for a fun kind of wild action comedy, I would recommend giving Kidnapping Inc. a try.
Okay. Wow. I mean, lots of different stuff that that we can recommend.
Oh yeah. Wide range of films to keep an eye out for.
All right. So that's it for Frameline for this week. For Courtney Small, I'm Barbara Wasowski. Thanks for listening.